Welcome to the Collector's Show, where you'll learn insider secrets about collecting everything. Best places to buy, how to judge authenticity, and what are the collectibles of the next generation. Here's your host, Harold Nickel.
Well, howdy, and welcome to another edition of the Collector's Show with me, Harold Nickel. You're going to want to stick around for the interview segment of the program because we're going to be talking about collecting Saturday morning toys or toys that were advertised on Saturday morning cartoons back during the 1960s. And if you grew up during that time, you're going to recognize the names of a lot of these toys, probably be reminded of some that you hadn't thought about since then, if you're like me. And I found some old advertisements that I'll play during the couple of breaks here during the show. Dana Kane is the woman who's going to step us through that. She's written several books on the topic, hosts different types of events for collectors in the Colorado area. She's a terrific guest, and you'll want to hang around to hear what Dana has to say. Of course, as always, we do the news from the world of collecting. And I don't know if I just started noticing it more since we talked with Brian of Brian's Toys, but there's lots of Star Wars collectibles in the news, it seems like, every week. And for like every one that I do here on the program, there's two or three that I don't do. There's a couple of companies, Sideshow and Hot Toys, they've partnered to bring another big bunch of collectibles for Star Wars. They've done, Sideshow that is, about 150 Star Wars figures just in the last 10 years. And a few of them were co-developed with this Hot Toys company. They have a very unique partnership with these highly anticipated new Star Wars films on the horizon. And frankly, that's what I think is causing the attention in the Star Wars space with these new collectibles. So you'll want to check out Sideshow and Hot Toys and their new partnership for more figures. And maybe I can figure out a way to get them to come on and talk about them. Well, we also talk, and you'll even hear Dana and I talk about trying to make money from collectibles. And you may remember a few weeks back, there was an article in Forbes about this. Well, now there's one, probably not coincidentally, in the Wall Street Journal, the September 21st issue by Andrew Blackman, who talks about the need to take stock, no pun intended, of the value of your collectibles. And he talks about the fact that people will get rid of or not really take care of the things that they've collected. His emphasis in his article is on art and antiques. But you know from listening to this program that you don't necessarily have to own things like that for them to be valuable. And we've talked in the news segment about people who have lost their collections because of hurricanes, earthquakes, floods, and theft. So I'll post a link to this to the Collector's Show website. And the Wall Street Journal, that's a pretty solid outfit. I think we can take what they say to the bank. And I intended every one of those puns. Now, how about the most expensive Godzilla collectible ever made? It is not a coincidence or a surprise, made of solid gold. For the person who may or may not have everything, a solid gold Godzilla, it's 9.5 inches tall, 7.5 inches wide, 14 inches long, and it weighs 33 pounds, and it's made of solid gold. And I'm sitting here looking at the picture, and it's a gold Godzilla. What else is there to say? Now, of course, the price, $1.5 million. I don't know what that converts to in per ounce. And the last time I looked, I think gold was around $1,300 an ounce. So I don't know. You might want to have this assayed before you plunk down $1.5 million for it. And if you've got that kind of money, take your assayer with you to the manufacturer. And I'll put this on the website, too. And I'm a huge fan of Godzilla. And if you hadn't seen the latest movie, I think it's out in, you can see it on your cable or your satellite dish system. It's pretty good. It's also faithful to the original Godzilla movies, particularly the later ones. And I don't want to give any more away than that. But if you've got $1.5 million burning a hole in your pocket, get you a solid gold Godzilla. So stay tuned now for the interview segment with Dana Kane, all about collecting from Saturday morning cartoons here on The Collector's Show with me, Harold Nickel, on Web Talk Radio. It's the interview segment of The Collector's Show. You know, I think just about every kid who grew up during the 1960s and 70s, at least what I experienced, was watching cartoons every Saturday morning. And there were really only a couple of shows I remember much about, but I remember the commercials much better than I do most of those TV shows. Our guest is Dana Kane. Dana is an avid doll and toy collector. She's also a published author and event promoter. She's written about everything from collecting Japanese movie posters to TV monsters, dinosaurs, and my personal favorite, Saturday morning TV collectibles. And Dana Kane, welcome to The Collector's Show.
Hi, Harold. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thanks for making time for us. And I got to just ask you right away as we go into this, were the Saturday morning cartoon producers and the toy manufacturers, were they in cahoots? Were they working together to come up with all these different tie-ins, or was that just sort of a coincidence?
That is, it's so funny. I was just talking about this the other day. You know, not at first. Back in the beginning, you know, cartoons and toys were utterly separate. The only time that they really merged was, as you said, during the commercials on Saturday morning. And I was trying to actually figure out and remember which toy crossover it was that started it all. And, you know, I was trying to figure out, was it My Little Pony that was the first one? Was that the first time when a toy became a cartoon? Because before that, they were doing, you know, they would, a cartoon would be popular and they'd make a toy out of it.
Right, right.
You know, that was normal. That became kind of normal. Like, you know, especially by the 70s, it was normal. If you had a popular cartoon, you'd put out a toy line, right? Or
right.
Even in the 60s. Even in the 50s, I had a Beanie and Cecil toy when I was teeny tiny teeny, right? Or maybe that was early 60s. But I think it was right around the time of My Little Pony. I want to say that was the first one that I remember where they put out a toy and then created a cartoon, and then the 80s just went nuts with that, didn't they?
Yeah, I think
but
that's
I'm
right.
Not saying that was the first one. I'm asking because I know it was right around that time, and I know, you know, there were Transformers and Thundercats and He-Man and all of those and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. By the 80s, it became sort of, which came first, the chicken or the egg? You couldn't really even keep track of which one you knew about first, the toy or the cartoon.
Well, and that's kind of why I was interested in it, because I think, obviously, the My Little Pony, which I never watched or owned, just to make that very clear,
sure.
may have been the first one. But, you know, G.I. Joe, I think, eventually became a cartoon but was a toy first, and I don't really know. But that's why I was curious, because obviously, you know, like you say, later on, it was all about the merchandising and not so much about the cartoon. I think it was just something that they stumbled onto, frankly.
Right, exactly. I think you're right. And I think, I remember the first time I saw a cartoon, and maybe it was Hasbro, because it was like, you know, it was on the cartoon show, and it said, you know, produced by, yeah. I just remember the toy company name being very prominent in the credits. So, yeah, whoever did figure it out was a genius.
Yeah, I think so. And I said I didn't really remember the programs. There's a couple I remember. I liked Space Ghost, and I really liked the Fantastic Four. But I don't think – well, I know I didn't have toys associated with either, and I don't know if there were any others. My chemistry set, though, was made by a company called Gilbert, and it looked like
right. It
was going to be just so interesting and fun from the commercial, but – my memory of it was that it was kind of boring. Do you have memories like that?
You just weren't combining the right chemicals.
Well, yeah.
It can be very interesting.
Well, and it was, in retrospect, absurdly dangerous, but...
Yeah.
But I remember following
the
cards.
That was the great thing about the 60s toys, is you could really hurt yourself. That was part of what made them fun, I think. My favorite in the 60s was Creepy Crawlers. I had Creepy Crawlers, Sunflowers, and Creeple People. And back in those days, you could burn yourself on one of those thing makers, you know?
That's right. We had.
And then they reissued them where it cooks with light bulbs and it takes, like, you know, half a century. But they're safe.
Yeah, and the other thing was a vacuum form. And I've never understood how that worked.
Yeah, those were fun. Those were really fun.
Yeah, my cousin had one of those, but the ads...
And a strange change machine.
All right, now that one I don't
remember
know about.
That one?
I don't know about that one. Tell me about that.
Oh, that was good.
It was, I guess, a really great era, the coming together of media and toys. I remember My Man from U.N.C.L.E. Spy Kit and things like that, but those were all for guys.
Wow.
Oh,
God, are you
girl,
kidding me? Well, I had the Ilya Kuryakin doll.
Okay.
You know, and I was so into Ilya Kuryakin, you know, and now MeTV just started airing Man from U.N.C.L.E. on Sunday nights, and I'm just in hog heaven rewatching them. Ah, oh, I know.
Well, and
great, MeTV.
The guy who
Sunday
played
night.
That. Yeah, the guy who played that is on one of the NCIS shows. I can't
David
think of
McCallum,
that.
Yeah.
Okay. But with all right, so we've sort of broke the gender barrier there with Ilya Kuryakin and my sister.
Well, and you know, I have a brother, so he had all the G.I. Joes and the Hot Wheels, and I had all the Barbies, and I mean, we played together all the time. We would combine like the Matchbox City and the train set and the dinosaurs, and we would mix them all together, and G.I. Joe would date Barbie. You know, so when I grew up, there wasn't a gender barrier because I got to play with all the boy toys and the girl toys. And one of my favorites from the 60s was my brother's Johnny 7 OMA one-man army machine gun.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God, I love that thing.
Yeah,
it shot the little white bullets and the grenades and the red torpedoes, and it had the Tommy gun machine gun sound.
You know what? I did have
it
one of those.
It stood up on the tripod.
That's right. It sure did. It sure did. It was that was a great toy. And toy guns in those days were like, they were everywhere. They were ubiquitous. I don't think anybody's allowed to have toy guns anymore. And my sister had an Easy Bake oven.
Yeah.
It ran on a light bulb, like you were saying before, but it came mm-hmm. with mixes that they were gone instantly, and I don't remember ever being able to find a replacement. Did you have things like that happen to you?
Well, I had the Easy Bake Oven in turquoise in the early 60s, but I was never very domestic, frankly. So I never used up all my mixes. I remember making one cake with my mom when I first got it. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it was like, you know, back to the Johnny 7 and the other stuff. I never really, you know, what I love about the Easy Bake ovens, though, is when you find them in the box now, it's just a great decoration. You know, for years I had one in my kitchen, like on top of the fridge as a decoration.
That is so cool.
But I don't cook either with a real oven or an easy bake oven. That's why God made restaurants.
Yes, and takeout. And
right.
So for people who listen to the program and me and you, we really had fun growing up playing with that stuff. But you made the move from collector to writer and then to ultimately event promoter. What made you decide to go from avid collector into writing and then your career as an event promoter?
Well, I'm not quite sure that order is exactly right, because I actually started running science fiction conventions back in the 70s before I wrote books. And I started my, I launched my first real toy show, Baby Boomerama, in Denver, and I want to say like 1990 or 89. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until the mid to late 90s that I started writing books. But yeah, at one point in time, I was running shows and doing a monthly toy auction and writing the toy books and running a shop.
Wow.
So what made me do it is that it's just so freaking fun, mm-hmm. you know? And once you get into it and you're buying toys and selling toys, it becomes normal to my background. Before that was I had a journalism degree. I was a writer and editor.
Okay.
So it made total sense for me to go ahead and start doing the articles and the books and the columns and all that stuff. And then, but my heart is really, I'm an event planner. Who are we kidding?
Mm-hmm.
I run so many events now, and it's just something that I just love to do. So
I've done
it suits my skill set.
Yeah, I've done trade shows, but they were for the chemical manufacturing industry. I can't imagine many jobs that are tougher than that of being an event planner. Is it a tough job? Because it's always like 10,000 things that can go wrong, and most
well,
of them
do. I used to think it was easy, and I'd say, oh, man, you need some extra money. You should run an event. And then after seeing like three or four of my friends just fail epically, I started thinking, maybe this isn't as easy as I think it is. Maybe it's just me. So I think it was because my background in science fiction conventions, where during the 70s, I literally like volunteered for every single job you could have. You know, I was the vendor liaison. I was the art show coordinator. I was the director. I was the guest liaison. And, you know, I was in charge of programming. I was in charge of ticketing. So once you do all those, then all of a sudden you know everything.
Yeah.
And what I do, Harold, is I just, the only events that I run are events that I want to run. Like I have a toy show.
Mm-hmm.
I have a chocolate festival.
Oh.
You know, I have the Vintage Voltage Expo, which is all vintage, you know, audio and stereo gear. And I have the Denver Modernism Show, which is all retro, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s. So, and my biggie now is the Denver County Fair, which is making headlines all over the world as the craziest county fair in America, mostly because it's outrageous, because I'd never actually been to a county fair when I designed it. So I just kind of, you know, put it together the way I thought it should be. And we have a geek pavilion and a kitten pavilion and a pot pavilion because we're in Denver and we can do that. So I just have fun with them. People ask me to run other events. I'm like, no, that doesn't sound very fun.
Yeah.
So, you know, fun is always at the forefront.
Well, I admire the fact that you only do the ones that are going to be fun. And I got a suggestion. You should have your chocolate festival and your pot pavilion next door to each other. For 'cause I've heard that you get hungry when you smoke marijuana. But like I say, I've only heard that.
Well, we have tons of food trucks, and there's no shortage of funnel cakes and corn dogs.
So,
for you know.
So, for people who collect and are considering the idea of getting into the business of selling their collections or selling to other collectors, what kind of advice can you give them? Who are the most successful sellers or exhibitors?
Well, you know, the advice that I always give people is to just, you know, buy what you love. Don't buy something because you think you're going to be able to sell it later.
Mm-hmm.
because that way lies madness, and it never really works out, you know. And if you get stuck with it, then you're okay because you love it.
Right.
So, you know, I just think people should, if you're going to buy and sell, that's fine. But, you know, stick with what you know, stick with what you love, and that way you can never go wrong. If you're looking for sales outlets, of course there's eBay, which mm-hmm. kind of screwed things up for some people. But it does exist.
Tell me about that. How did they mess things up?
Well, you know, back in the day, if you were a collector, you could, and you wanted that one last crowning thing for your collection.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would go to all the shows. You would go to all the shops. Oh, you know, maybe they'll have the Johnny 7 OMA one-man army machine gun. And you just have to, you would literally have to go to the show, have to go to the shop. You know, you would scour the countryside looking for it. And it might take you 3 or 4 or 5 years to find it.
Right.
And when you did find it, you would like burst into tears. You'd be so happy and so giddy and overcome, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, you're looking for that one magical thing. You just go on eBay and there's a page and a half of them.
Right.
You know, for $5. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the magic is gone.
So, right. And, you know, well, the joy of the hunt is gone.
Right.
That's what's gone.
Right.
Because for collecting, half the fun, or maybe three quarters of the fun, is the hunt.
Yes.
You know, I mean, who wants to collect something if you look on eBay and they're all just sitting there and you can just go click, 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 there, got it, collection done,
yeah.
You know?
It does take the thrill of the hunt out of it. And it's funny. I remember, and this has been probably 30, 35 years ago, there was an artist that I was a big fan of, and I went looking for some of his work, and eventually I found it through some of his relatives. But this was in the days before the internet and before eBay, and I mean, you had to get on the phone and really track things down. And when I finally found a big collection of this guy's materials, it was like scoring the winning touchdown. It was just a terrific feeling. And
what artist was it? I'm an art collector now. That's my primary collection right now.
Okay. Now I'm going to have to remember this guy's name. Oh, man. George. I'll remember George's last name eventually. And when I do the recap of the show, I'll have time to go look and tell the listeners. Hinky. H-E-I-N-K-E, and he was he painted Santa Claus portraits. And when I was little,
wow,
I just loved this guy. Well, I found, I think, like his granddaughter or great-granddaughter, somebody like that, but I was able to get some of his stuff. And it was, like I say, it was like a big deal to have found that. We had some guys on a couple of weeks ago who were document collectors, and they talked about the fun or the thrill of coming across the only copy of a certain document. So I take your meaning when you say you go on eBay and there's, you know, two dozen of whatever, and you just buy the maybe the least expensive one or the one that looks like it's in the best shape. So yeah, I know what you're saying. Well, let's take a quick look back at the Johnny 7 one-man army, the way he was advertised to kids on Saturday morning back in the mid-1960s.
Your squad is ready for you to lead them through. With Johnny 7 OMA, you charge! Fire grenade! Bullseye for Johnny 7! Watch out, tank! Fire anti-armor shell. Fire anti-tank rocket. Johnny 7's got him on the run. Johnny 7 fires bullets like a rifle. Fires like a Tommy gun. Now it's a cap-firing pistol. You've won with Johnny 7, the one-man army gun. It's 7 guns in one. Let's count them. 1 is a grenade launcher. 2 anti-armor gun. 3 anti-tank gun. 4 bullet-firing rifle. 5 Tommy gun, 6 anti-bunker gun, 7 cap-firing pistol, There's no other gun like it. To be sure, look for Johnny 7, OMA, the one-man army by Topper.
But we'll get back to Dana here in just a minute. I just wanted to let you know that the Johnny 7 one-man army gun was the best-selling boys toy, I think, in 1964. I found an article in Time magazine. It's the 50th of their top 100 toys of all time, according to an article by Allie Townsend that was published February 16th, 2011. And the ad that I just played for it was one that I remember seeing as a kid. So I just thought I'd throw that in. I hadn't thought about this toy in ages, and I remembered having it, but I couldn't remember what it was called. The Johnny 7 One-Man Army. Pretty cool. Another ad coming up, and then back to Dana here on the Collector's Show with me, Harold Nickel, on Web Talk Radio.
You probably think I'm just an ordinary guy, but in the sinister world of counter-espionage, I'm known as Agent Zero M. Interesting equipment in counterintelligence, like this portable radio. Supposing I'm here in Monte Carlo, trapped by enemy agents, I'd play it cool. Just want to hear a little music. That's a tune they didn't expect. The new Zero M radio rifle. Looks like a radio, but touch this button. Rather neat, eh? So's this. The Zero M jet coder pen has 2 points. Writes a secret message you can see only with these glasses. And fires a jet of water 30 feet. To get your Zero M radio rifle and jet coder, just remember the password.
Bobby, are you going to mow the lawn or not?
The password? Zero M.
So, Dana, it sounds like the people who do well are the people who buy the things that they like, and if they sell them, great, and if they don't sell, that's okay too. Give us some examples, though, of people who have really, as you say, failed epically in their pursuit.
Well, the easiest way to fail is to break the cardinal rule, that is, if it says it's collectible, it's not. Mm-hmm. We've all seen it happen. Everybody remembers the Beanie Baby crash. Most people probably remember the Death of Superman comic, where it came out and you know, on the 5 o'clock news, they're like, everybody's buying this comic, it's going to be so collectible. Mm-hmm. And they're interviewing people who say, I'm going to put my kid through college with this comic one day. And it's like, I'm just sitting there watching this going, oh my God, don't they realize it's the price point is peaking right now today, you know? Mm-hmm. Sure enough, you know, you just can't give them away now because everybody and his dog bought it and
That's right.
saved it.
And all of these death of fill in the blank, they're all just a big fake out, you know? I mean, they're no more.
Well, I understand that the comic companies want to, you know, they're just like the TV stations. They need their ratings. They need their sales. They need their, you know, everybody's. You really have to make a splash these days to get attention. So, you That's know, right. you can't blame the comic companies, but you can blame the people who buy into them for investor reasons.
Yeah, there's an article that I put on the website, I guess, a couple of weeks back that talked about treating your collections like investments. And overall, and this is a thread that has run throughout the Collector's Show since we started it, is like you say, buy the things and collect the things that you enjoy having. If you make money at it, great, but don't plan on it. And I think that's just good advice. And as long as we're going to point the bony finger of blame, the people who label these things collectible, that's so uncool. It's just misleading. It's not going to go up in value.
Right. You know, Holiday Barbie's another prime example. Yeah,
we got a room full of those here.
Yeah, but one of the now, the other side of that coin is if you do want to find something that you can make a lot of money on, you know, hit up the yard sales, garage sales, estate sales, flea markets, thrift stores. That's where you find the stuff. Mm-hmm. That's where you make those magic finds, and you can pick something up for 25 cents that's worth $100,
right.
You know? And, you know, that's very thrilling. You know, it goes back to what we're saying about eBay, kind of, yeah, you might be able to find something on eBay with a typo in it that you get
right.
for a good deal. But, yeah, that's the thrill of the hunt,
yeah.
is finding something that you love that's super cool and valuable, you know, at a yard sale or something like that.
Well, you've had such an awesome career, writer, collector, science fiction author, event producer. What is next for Dana Kane?
Well, the very next thing I'm doing is my Collector's Super Show, which is my big toy and doll and comic and everything else Collector's Super Show, is coming up Sunday, October 12th.
Okay.
In Denver, actually in North Glen, which is up at I-25 and 120th at the Ramada Plaza Convention Center. And it's 11 to 3, so, you know, it's not a huge time investment if somebody wants to sell at it or come shop at it.
Right.
$5 to get in, and we've got like 150 tables of, you know, vintage and collectible toys and dolls and comics and all that fun stuff. That's my very next thing.
Sunday, October the 12th. From
right.
And it's, for those listeners who are in Colorado, it's at the Ramada Plaza Convention Center in North Glen. 150 exhibitors, $5 to get in. It's a pretty good way to spend a Sunday, it sounds like to me.
It's a great way to spend a Sunday. And anybody that wants to see all the shows I run or get more information on that one, they can just go to danacain.com, danacain.com. And also, if they go there, there's not only all my events, but also my art collection is mm-hmm. mostly online. And that's my big thing right now is collecting local Denver art, and it's pretty awesome.
I did have a chance to look at it when I was getting ready for the show, and I also want to tell folks that the books that you have written are available on Amazon.
Right, yeah.
Well, Dana Kane, thank you so much for making time for us on the Collector Show this week.
Harold, it was a blast. Anytime.
Stay tuned for one more quick word right after this. It's the Collector Show with Harold Nickel.
Sit down, Bond. Yeah, your 007 ring.
It leaves the 007 seal.
Your 007 ID bracelet conceals ammunition and message pellets for use with the 007 pen.
An ordinary pen, isn't it?
It writes like one, but it projects messages over 20 feet.
Ingenious.
And should you find yourself trapped, you merely whistle for help. Then by placing ammunition in that slot...
Careful, Bond!
This is vapor paper, writing messages to our agents. Drop it in water.
Astonishing.
Good luck, Bond. You're on your own.
Get your 007 secret agent pen and disappearing vapor paper separately or packaged with a 007 secret agent ring and ID bracelet. You'll get a bang out of it. By American Character.
Well, that does it for another week's worth of The Collector's Show. I want to thank Dana Kane for being with us and sharing her expertise about toys from the 1960s. And it's really fun, for me at least, to remember those old advertisements and those toys from the 60s. That commercial about the spy kit, the water pen that shoots 30 feet. The kid that was in that ad is Kurt Russell. And Kurt Russell was a child star and was in a lot of different Disney productions back during the 1960s. And, of course, he was a big movie star in the 90s, married Goldie Hawn, and, you know, turned out pretty good. But it was Kurt Russell in that ad. So, love sharing stuff like that with you. All right, next week, another first for the Collector's Show, collecting air sickness bags, or as they are also known, barf bags. And I'm not making this up. I know I said it was going to be this week. I've done the interview already. it's probably the funniest interview we've ever done. Barf bags next week on the Collector Show. You don't want to miss that here on Web Talk Radio. Thanks for being here. See you next week.
The tanks have been wiped out by a wall of flames. Neither man nor his machines are able to stop this creature.